I'm Crosby Kemper, the director of the Kansas City Public Library, which I guess you all know because you were all downstairs before. But anyway, thanks for coming tonight and for helping us open the Orville Hixson Gallery in the film vault of the Kansas City Public Library and here to hear Dr. David Shields talk about Orville Hixson and the photography of Hollywood and the 20s and 30s. Again, I want to thank Jim Finley and the Hixson family and Butch Rigby, John Shipp, and the Film Society, and Olga Marr for making possible the great Hixson photographs that we have downstairs, the great film book collection. I want to thank the Durwood Foundation for the film vault. I think we're creating a really great film experience for Kansas City. And tonight, to extend that film experience and our interest in photography, Dr. David Shields, who's the McClintock Professor of Southern Letters in the Departments of English and History at the University of South Carolina, the author of the upcoming book, The Magic Mirror, Photography in American Silent Cinema, which will be published by Harvard University Press, the first survey of influential photographers whose portraits and film stills help promote individual celebrities in the culture of the early silent cinema. And I think we forget how important photography and the presentation of these great film stars was in the posters, in the photographs, in the newspaper, in the collectibles that came out. And the romance of the stars that you see downstairs in the Hixson photographs really created an almost mythical image of the cinema and created this culture of celebrity that is still very, very strong in our country. So this should be a most interesting presentation, and I'm really grateful to Dr. Shields for being here. David Shields.
I want to make sure that my microphone works and that I'm projecting clearly and that people in the back row are fine with this. Right. I want to begin by describing my first encounter with an Orville Hixson photograph. Sometime in the mid-1990s, I became irritated with the fact that no adequate, indeed no history of the visual culture of the performing arts for the early part of the 20th century existed. You had individual treatments of a glamour photographer such as George Harrell, or Napoleon Cerroni in the 19th century, but no overarching narrative about that splendid wealth of camera artists who represented the efflorescence and death of vaudeville, the rise of glamour and silent cinema, and the establishment of a truly extraordinarily influential spectacle world of the American stage on Broadway. And so there reached a point where I decided, well, if no one's going to write this book, I'm going to write it. So I began the systematic investigation of the photography of the stage, the dance, and silent cinema. And I was in the New York Public Library in the Billy Rose Collection, which is one of the absolute greatest collections of ephemera and photography recording the stage in the United States. And I'd spent about 2 hours riffling through hundreds of glamour photographs of starlets and Ziegfeld Corines and things like that. And I came across a photograph that absolutely stopped me. It was of one of those extravagant personalities that emerged in the second decade of the 20th century, Olga Petrova. And she was sort of emerging out of a shadow, and she was angry. I mean, really angry. Angry to the point of almost being on the verge of madness. And the space was indistinct. In the background, there was light, and it looked like the light was trembling, or was like flames coming up in the background. And it reminded me of that old proverb, angry people are seldom beautiful. Beware those who are. Because she was just, she was a middle-aged woman, and she was terribly angry, but she was terribly powerful and alluring too. I looked down, and there in the corner is the name Hixson Conley. It's the only photograph I remember from that session of looking for several hours on this afternoon. When I was asked to come and speak today about Orville Hixson, I called up the people in the Billy Rose collection to get a JPEG of this photograph, and they informed me that it was missing. Someone has stolen the photograph. A testament to the power and allure. After all of these years, this must have been taken in 1919 of that image. So I'm not beginning with a picture of Olga Petrova glaring out, but that was what made me pay attention to Orville Hixson, and he began to occupy an increasingly prominent place in my sense of what happened in the story of performing arts photography in America. Orville Hixson was one of a trio of Midwestern photographers who, during the second and third decades of the 20th century, gained national and perhaps international fame as a portraitist of performers. Along with Homer K. Payton of Kansas City and Wilson Todd of St. Louis, Hixson won the interest of the New York City editors of the great national magazines, the Slicks, as they were called in the print trade because of their polished paper and high-quality halftone illustrations. Hixson shared with Payton of the studio Strauss Payton and Todd an artistic approach to his subjects, a painterly approach to posing and lighting sitters, a willingness to disrupt the mechanical reproduction of scenes by manipulating the negative to create stylized backgrounds, and a predilection for whole body and half-length portraits instead of the torso and head shots that increasingly became popular among society photographers. And all of them focused upon the most extravagantly expressive subjects available, theatrical personalities. If this trio of photographers shared an artistic vision, they arrived at it via different paths. Homer K. Payton began as a graphic artist whom photographer Benjamin Strauss, employed as a retoucher in his photography studio in Kansas City. Payton's aggressive reworking of the negatives produced such astonishingly eye-arresting results that Strauss took him on as a full partner and taught him the art of posing and developing. In 1910, they established themselves as the most artistic studio in Kansas City. Wilson Todd was trained as a photographer in the Signal Corps of the U.S. Army in World War I. He became enamored of his craft, studied the professional journals, and upon his decommissioning in 1918, moved to St. Louis and established a studio. Here is a characteristic Wilson Todd photograph with an interesting painted background and a kind of stylish flapper performer from vaudeville. Hixson, unlike the other two, was a self-taught amateur photographer who first became employed in the print world.
Audio missing due to technical problems.
In particular, they experimented with rendering shadows more dynamic with electric lamps. Here is Evelyn Nesbitt Thaw, a beauty who was notorious in the early 20th century, the girl in the red velvet swing, the subject of one of the great murder mysteries, or, well, it wasn't too much of a mystery. It was a straight rage of jealousy shooting by her husband, a lover. And she was as iconic a beauty in the first half, in the first, well, three decades of the 20th century as Audrey Hepburn was in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. Notice the lighting on this. We have at least two lamps, one from right, one from left. You see the face lit from above and the arm lit from the right side.
Is it possible to have the lights turned off in the room so we can see?
That's magic, isn't it? This use of electric lights against a non-existent background made his images more modern than those taken by theatrical and fashion photographers who used painted backdrops, the Gainsborough glades and classical pillars and swag curtains that were the standard equipment in the high-end professional studios. Here is the great New York society photographer of the 19-teens, Ira L. Hill, who got the scene painters from the Metropolitan Opera to come and paint his background paintings for his studio. There's something a bit old-fashioned about this. This is absolutely contemporary with the Evelyn Nesbitt Thaw photo you just saw, which is much more modern in its conception. Another thing that Hickson taught Connolly was to scrape emulsion off the large glass negatives and to ripple developer and to use acetone to develop back distort backgrounds when the prints were produced. By 1917, Hickson and Connolly's high-key lighting, their chiaroscuro, and the abstract work backgrounds were influencing their rival, Strauss Peyton. Here is a version of an image which appears down in the exhibition downstairs, more as a headshot in the print that you have, but you can see this extraordinarily sort of rippled light effect on the right side caused by dissolving the negatives coating and swirling it with the tip of a brush at various points and creating a very interesting effect here. Connolly worked at Hickson's side for about a year and a half before America's entry into the First World War prompted Connolly to enlist in the Signal Corps. During Connolly's service, Hickson preserved the brand name, though he worked alone. In 1921, he bought out Connolly's share of the partnership. With the money, Connolly set up his own studio in Chicago and began a 20-year career as a prominent theatrical photographer there. Here are two Connolly images. This is the one which established him as a photographer in Chicago, Ernestine Meyer. Actually, Hixson took this photograph and Conley took the negative with him to Chicago. Once he got it published, he got a name. And he's a good photographer, so he could do his own. Here's Mabel Ford of the Ford sisters, a vaudevillian sister act. And you can see that we have a fan and then some abstractly manipulated background. You can't tell quite what it is, but very much in the Hixson mode. Sometime in the 1940s, Conley got the playwriting bug, and this supplanted picture making in Conley's heart. One of the things which is sort of characteristic about Conley's portraits is that he focuses much more on the bust and head than Hixson, but you can see the very characteristic Kansas City handling of the background with negative painting and scraping prominently evident in the early 1920s images particularly. This handling of the background, as I said, was a signature of the Kansas City style of theatrical portraiture and had been developed by Peyton and Hixson, each developing a different strand of it. But it also became a characteristic mode of the most ambitious camera artists that were concerned with the life of the stage in New York City. And all of these photographers taking up of this style has to be understood to some extent as a reaction to the way of presenting images developed by the motion picture studios. After the development of the motion picture magazines in 1911. From 1911 to 1929, motion picture still photography underwent a steady process of industrialization in the studios in Fort Lee, New York, and Hollywood. The lighting, decor, exposure, and development were performed by different specialists. The artistry of a photo owed as much to a set designer or an arc light technician as to the master of the lens. Beginning with the New York Paramount Studio in 1919, photographers were even segregated into still specialists and portrait gallery cameramen. Once the negative left the hand of the still or portrait photographer, they became the preserve of the retouchers and then the developers. The publicity office, usually in New York City, decided which images would be released for exploitation. And because placement in newspapers and cheap paper motion picture magazines, in which the duotone reproduction process were the crudest, was the highest wish of the PR departments, the most effective stills did not have subtle toning effects and favored lighter backgrounds and few rather than more subjects. And here we have Louise Lovely in a characteristic Hollywood portrait photograph with a plain white background which reproduces well on cheap newspaper. The ideal Hollywood print would be heavily retouched. It would be in clear focus and rather straight in its setup. It made obvious points by presenting intelligible conflicts. Here we have Louise Lovely and a lobby still. And these would be displayed on the week before a particular film was going to be shown at the theater. Anyone walking into the still would know what Rich Man's Darling was all about in one instant. Now that's terror. In the face of the motion pictures striving for a mass response through engineered images, a small group of performing arts photographers in New York, especially in Kansas City and in Chicago, who were oriented toward the stage more than the screen and concerned themselves as much with visual poetry as the publicity value of their images, stressed the hand of the artist, and they deviated from the straight reproduction of scenes, what was in front of the lens. They sought out painterly or graphic effects in the pictorial field. The first person that we know to have done this, who belongs to this movement, was a man named Frank Bangs. And in 1911, in a theater magazine, he publishes this photograph of Ivy Trautman. And all of this background here is not a background painting. This was painted directly on the negative by the artist. This rather bizarre photograph of Gertrude Hoffman, the dancer, also has an interesting combination of painted dimensions. Some of this thing is back projected, and there are actual props down here in a truly interesting creation of an illusionist and fanciful image. This is not at all something that the people in Hollywood were interested in developing. Bangs was an actor who had turned into a photographer, and he had a particularly acute sense of the expressive potentialities of violating strict verisimilitude. Now, one of the things that which he was interested in was, on the stage, there are very dramatic moments in lighting, but all stage production stills are never taken in the middle of a performance, because the flash that's required to illuminate the stage would disrupt the action. So what happens is, usually on the dress rehearsal run of a show, after someone had run the scene, they would reassemble all the actors and try to recreate sort of tableaus of the key moments, and they were very dead. You can take a look at all of the scenic photography of White Studios, who is the Schubert theater photographer of choice, and you will see dead scene still after dead scene still from this period. Bangs knew what magic lighting could do, and he particularly loved close-up effects. So what he sought to do was, in his studio, reproduce the actual kind of performance moment with electric lamps, close-up, and then create a kind of envelope, stylistically reflecting the passions that were going on by not using a painted back set, but painting it directly on the film. Actually, the history of the painted photograph is a long history, and the greatest theatrical photographer of the 19th century, Napoleon Sarony, was famous for his painted photographs. But there's something new that's going on when Bangs creates this new approach. And that element which is so essential is the electric lamp, which permitted this strong chiaroscuro contrast, the feeling of an actual stage performance. And it also led to an expressive stylization. Kansas City was the first hotbed of this new sort of mixed graphic photographic image, with Homer K. Payton of Strauss Payton and Orville Hickson of Hickson Connolly vying to be the more extravagant manipulator of the backgrounds of the sitters. Payton would be the first to draw national attention to Kansas City in 1913. And Payton was a genius at the treatment of background textures, and one of the things I thought I would do is pass around some actual prints of Strauss Payton so you can, you know, actually handle some and take a look up close what these things look like. As I said, Peyton was a genius at the treatment of background textures and could paint negatives in ways that were impressionistic, Art Nouveau, or geometric. His partner, Benjamin Strauss, had a talent for posing. Between the two, they generated a series of memorable images that received national distribution in the magazines. Hixson, in 1914, launched his career paralleling the Strauss-Peyton free manner of manipulating the background. And Hixson quickly mastered painting negatives for background. And in his women's portraits of the 19-teens, he rivaled Peyton as a sylvan impressionist. Here's an image from the 1919 Harriet Rempel. And you can see very much, this almost looks like one of those Ira Hill background paintings, but it's painted directly on the negative. This is a more traditional sort of image by Hixson. And here's the famous flying alcova, in which he actually shot her. She was lying on a table, shoots down on the table, dissolves the background with acetone, takes lamp back, and paints this extraordinary sort of expressionist atmosphere around her, creating a truly sense of someone plunging through the ether. Hixson favored a looser, more dynamic and expressionist style that we can see here in this 1920 image. The aggressiveness of his intervention into the pictorial field was immediately registered by the larger world of photography. It marked a distinct step away from the sort of soft focus aesthetic and diffused natural lighting that prevailed among the more artistic of the performing arts photographers. The prints of these artists produced were subtly toned, often graphically detailed and striking in pose. Here's Arnold Genthy's photograph of the great actress Elsie Ferguson. Their frequently shadowed or textured backgrounds didn't lend themselves to newspaper reproduction. These pictorialists, performing arts photographers, sought publication in the slicks, the large circulation national magazines, Vanity Fair, Century, Town and Country, Shadowland, Theater Magazine, Harper's Bazaar. These magazines had duotone or gravure reproductions and could reproduce this tonal gradation with greater fidelity. Hixson's entry into the world of the slicks took place in January 1917 with a full-length portrait in costume of dancer Ruth St. Denis appearing in Theater Magazine. St. Denis appears in exotic Oriental finery, posed with the practiced plasticity that made dancers the favorite of all sitters for artistic photographers, and she looms out of that dark background. St. Denis appears as a creature having little to do with the quotidian reality of World War I era America. Once this image appeared, demand for Hixson's work grew rapidly. And in 1919, he became one of the three first call photographers for Theater Magazine, placing multiple images, and he also is appearing in Vanity Fair. A word about St. Denis. She cultivated photographers and went out of her way to establish a special relationship with several. Hixson, of course, the West Coast pictorialist Arthur Kales, Herman Mishkin of the Metropolitan Opera, and Benjamin Falk. Her pictorial archives is in the New York Public Library, and it's visible to anyone who wants to see it because it's part of their digital archive, which you can access on the World Wide Web. So if you want a comparative sense of how Hixson portrays fanciful subject compared to other photographers, that's the first place to take a look. And you can see, his truly distinctive handling of things. A second very strong performer advocate for Hickson was Valeska Surratt, who first sat for Hickson in 1916 and did so repeatedly for the next several years. Surratt was a notoriously self-enchanted woman. And she was one of the four women in early 20th century show business who controlled every aspect of her visual presentation and representation. She's now best known as a silent screen vamp, a kind of black widow in a spider's web gown. Yet she was one of the more adventurous explorers of feminine visual personae on the stage or on the screen. She was born in Owensville, Indiana on June 28, 1882, and then she moved to Terre Haute. And there as a teenager, she first encountered the world of fashion working as a photographic retoucher in the Claire Sisters photography shop. And she became avid to own the dresses that were worn by the fashionable subjects of the Claire Sisters sittings. So she saved her money, moved to Indianapolis, and trained to be a milliner. She began making knockoffs for herself, the latest New York and Paris frocks, and then she became seized by desire to be a stage performer. She convinced her mother in 1904 to move to Chicago to secure dance and voice training, and after 2 years of intense tutelage, she moved to New York City. She designed a gown that combined the most striking features of the year's fashion. She made a stairway descent at a swank hotel favored by theatrical producers and caught the eye of Edward Elliston, who featured her in The Belle of Mayfair. She followed stage a success with a brief but intense motion picture vogue and a more enduring popularity on the vaudeville stage, where she wrote her own skits, designed her own sets, made her own costumes, picked her own collaborators, and she was intensely demanding on photographers, having been trained as one herself. She constantly suffered disappointment because of their unwillingness to enter fully upon her sometimes outré flights of fancy. Orville Hickson, however, delighted her with his willingness to visualize the new, the uncanny, the bizarre, and the ornate. Looking at these images, one is struck immediately by their grand guignol staginess, their disinterest in the growing visual language of glamour, and their audacity of pose and expression. It's interesting to think about glamour. Glamour was cultivating an image of effortless and expressionless allure. It was sort of the offspring of the movie Close-Up. If your camera's close to a face, you don't want to have too pronounced an expression, or else it'll be caricature. Glamour celebrated the radiant but passive face and the elegant yet relaxed body. We can think of that Arnold Genthe image of Elsie Ferguson. Or this. This is an Alfred Chaney Johnson photograph. Actually, two of them. And I bring this up because Johnston broke into Theater Magazine the exact same year as Hickson. But whereas Hickson's posing is extraordinarily dynamic, and his desire is to get the most extravagant facial expressions he can, here we see these Ziegfeld actresses as though they're serene, well, self-possessed, patrician beauties. And they don't engage with their eyes any onlooker. They're indifferent to you. How different from those extravagant vaudeville personalities who have to engage everyone in the audience all the way back to the back row. You know, glamour comes out of a world where there is no audience on the sound stage, you know, or the non-sound stage in the silence cinema, the movie set. Vaudeville photography deals with stage personalities, people who were ordered to get bookings or billings, had to project extraordinarily extravagant distinctiveness from everyone else. And what Hixson is the great chronicler of this set of people who have become virtuosos in the very limits of human expression. You can think of him as an anti-glamorist, in a way. He's a photographer of what the theater people of that age called personality, that thing which etched you as a distinctive and memorable presence. In the late 19-teens, Hixson became so fascinated with the expressive potentials of the body that he began to do away with backgrounds altogether, enveloping the figure in a high-key field of dark and light. These intense chiaroscuro effects were often side-lit by electric lamps positioned close to the subject. Some of these lamps were custom-built for Hixson by George Curtis, the motion picture pioneer and one-time partner of Benjamin Strauss. Curtis, I don't know if, you know, much has been done with him, but he was working in motion pictures in the late 1890s here in Kansas City, and someone whose work I think has to be documented with great care. In 1920, Hixson moved into the Baltimore Hotel on Main Street, where he would operate his Main Street studio for 10 years until the collapse of vaudeville. During that time, he entered into two partnerships, one with H. Kenyon Newman in 1923. And here is, these are some of the extravagant vaudeville sort of personalities. Here's the Hixson studio in the Baltimore Hotel on Main Street. You can take a look at that Koslov photograph, again, gesture at the limits. Here's a picture by H. Kenyon Newman of B.B. Daniels, the film photographer, and one of the Hixson Newman photographs, one in 1923. They had their partnership. And in 1926, he entered into a partnership with photographer James A. Weiss. And this partnership lasted intermittently, we think, until 28. Yesterday, I was going through some photos with Jim Finley, and this is from 26. There is a James Weiss photograph signed by exclusively James Weiss from 27, and then another Hixson Weiss photograph in 28. So sorting out that relationship is going to take some archival work. And at this juncture, he's expanding a network of studios out into the countryside. A Hixson portrait was a dialogue visualized. The passion and expression of the sitter appeared in a visual envelope created by Hixson. A harmonious consonance of mood characterized the greatest images. Because Hixson invited the sitter to explore the extremities of expression, and because he was quite aggressive in manipulating the visual space or the visual field of the negative surrounding the figure, the risk of a dissonance between sitter and the background was great. And I think the hallmark of Hixson's power as a photographer was the number of effective images he generated during the 14-year heyday of his career from 1916 to 1930. He did not get too many of the images wrong. When we look at the handful of notable performing arts photographers who were his contemporaries, his accomplishments become clearer. William Mortensen, who followed a parallel aesthetic path in California, while capable of masterworks like this photo of Sojin on the left-hand side, suffered from sensationalism and a penchant for tastelessness like this Bromwell photo of a vampire on the right-hand side. G. Mallard Kessler in New York shared Hickson's skill at manipulating negatives, but he comes curiously fixated on faces as his career goes on. And we can think about other people. Nicholas Murray had the same interest as Hickson in the whole body, but he liked to have the security of a back wall against which to outline his figures. Hickson's uncertain background spaces were more daring, more mysterious. And Hickson influenced all of these photographers, Mortensen, Kessler, Murray. In the middle of the 1920s, this tradition of performing arts photography had an additional sort of alteration take place with a move in the direction of a more graphic, engraved style. And this was due to a man named M.I. Boris. This was the royal photographer of Bulgaria before he shows up in New York City in the 1920s and is hired by Paramount Studios. He was trained in Vienna in the graphic aesthetics of Klinger and the symbolist rhetoric of von Stuck. And he reworked photographs with an engraving tool until they seemed engravings. And here are his photographs. Quite remarkable images, too. From 1911 until the Second World War, the group of camera artists I presented here, a group in which Orville Hickson operated centrally, exhibited and published the most popularly appreciated and aesthetically influential dissident photographic aesthetic in the United States. While the Hollywood glamorists sought the manufactured mechanical perfect vision of radiant beauty, and while artistic modernists toyed with abstraction and left photojournalism, the celebration of the machine, and clear focus imagery, this tradition of performing arts photographs demanded the liberty to impose the artist's sense of gesture into the pictorial field and chose to capture a group of sitters capable of the extravagant extremes of expression. This extravagant free play was kept alive to some extent by fashion photographers in the last half of the 20th century, but has only really come into its own recently with the rise of digital photography, when technology enabled the photographer to manipulate every aspect of the picture with ease. Only now is the experimental and aggressive idea of the photographer's place in the picture found in the work of Hickson, Peyton, Mortensen, and Boris seems like the path to the pictorial future. Thank you. Sure.
Questions?
Yeah, if you have a question, I'll try to answer them. Yes?
How does retouching compare to airbrushing?
Airbrushing is a sort of later technique of retouching. Originally, retouching was done usually by an assistant in an the photographer's studio, who used a pencil with a very fine point, and every imperfection in the negative would be filled in. It would take a tremendous amount of time to retouch a photograph. With the development of the airbrush pen, of course, you can treat fields, and I know some of you have photoshopped photographs and done the quick and dirty with this in terms of filling in cracks and things like that that have developed on your own family photographs. But the airbrush was, for a period of time, in the particularly from the mid-70s to the 90s, an extraordinarily popular way of doing retouching quickly. Okay.
I had the pleasure of knowing Orville and met him in 1979 when he was 85 years old, and met him at his home several times, and he showed me how he would retouch. And he would take his finger or a Q-tip or a dab of sponge and lamp black and make the light areas on the finished print. And he would take an intaglio tool or the corner of a razor blade and make the dark areas on the print. And I heard him say once that he could take 10 years and 10 pounds off the photograph at any moment.
That's right. That's right.
He was a master, and he was very old at the time, and his eyes weren't very good. His hands were a little shaky. But, you know, he would take one of his old secondhand 16 by 20 glass plates and show me how he did it. It was just wonderful. He was quite an artist. And
Plastic surgery without pain. That's right.
Photoshop of his era.
Right.
I realize you don't have all of his work on display, but I didn't see any photographs of Harold Lloyd or Buster Keaton. Did he do any of that work?
You know, it's an interesting question whether Buster Keaton, of the two, was the more prone to be out doing publicity tours. And he was, you know, both Keaton and Lloyd were almost exclusively involved in films with very little stage work from 1916 to 30. But I know that Keaton was in Kansas City on three occasions in the 1920s, and it's entirely conceivable that that he could have had a sitting with Hixson. We don't know what all the sittings that Hixson made. I don't think there was a record book kept, was there?
There was one time, but I think it's gone, a record. But he had hundreds, if not thousands, of performers. He kept just a few of these distorted memories. He never thought he would print from them. We're still looking for it. I mean, he commented about taking pictures of Fanny Bryce, Will Rogers, the one from Kansas City. Rogers, yeah. He was a friend of Buddy Rogers before he went to Hollywood, and then after he made it big.
Buddy Rogers, a handsome guy, too.
Right.
Not as handsome as Rubini, though. Here's a virtuoso picture of a virtuoso.
One more comment. Yeah. The one thing that really has been brought out that David did was that I missed a good thing. Both these locations are just within a block and a half of here. So all these pictures were taken just within a couple of blocks. So it's great that the library has brought this all back full circle.
Across on any interesting anecdotes from some of the sitters?
I haven't. I'm sure there are some. Maybe the Jim or Charles, anecdotes from the various sitters that were told by what? I mean, there is story about his involvement with Valeska Surratt, but
we have more negatives of Valeska Surratt than anybody else. Gladys, his wife, who wasn't married at the time, he was doing most of this. Interview, she said that was his girlfriend, and she laughed. Come in, look at the mirror, and say, you beautiful lady, you beautiful person. And she would always demand fresh flowers. And so Orville would get in his Packard and take her on a drive. parks trying to find these fresh flowers. And they said they never found any, but they spent the day together and they had a great day together.
I can imagine that she was a very galvanic person to have as a close friend. No other questions? Well, it was a pleasure talking to you.